So, hello for Datengarten 102. I'm really happy to have Harald here, who will talk about cellular base station technology. So, mainly tell us how all this works, where we get our internet for our mobile phones off and stuff like that. And I'm really curious about that. And yeah, if you have any questions, please wait with them till the end. And then you'll get the microphone from me, because if you don't do this, it will be kind of a game of Jeopardy for everybody on the stream and in the video later, because they will hear the answer but have to guess the question. So, without further ado, please a warm welcome applause for Harald.
Yeah. Thanks, everyone. So cellular base station technology, that's of course an extremely wide topic, and this is not really going to be a talk that goes into details of protocols or protocol stacks or network architecture or ladder diagrams of signaling messages or anything like that. It's really more about the physical side of cellular base stations, like what kind of actual like building blocks or devices do we find there. And how did these devices evolve over the last 20 years from 2G to 4G or even 5G to some extent? And I find this topic interesting, of course, but it's also a topic where it's rather difficult if you don't work in this field professionally to learn much about it, because all the documentation and all the user manuals for all these devices is not publicly disclosed by the respective manufacturers, so all you can find are some leaked documents. Just a second. No. Nah. Sorry for that. So, so it's, and that's why I thought it would be interesting to talk about it, because it's, as I said, rather difficult to find information, and not many people have worked with the related devices and so on. So I myself, I've been working on free software and open source hardware for more than 20 years now, used to do some Linux work a long time ago, and now the last 10 years I'm focusing on implementing cellular technology in open source software, and this talk is not about it. It's not about any of the open source projects, or not about the general purpose software defined radios that people use in the hobbyist community, but it's really about the commercial professional cellular base station equipment which is deployed in the field today and during the last decades. So let's start with a rather stupid question: what's actually a cellular base station? Well, functionally, it transmits and receives signals from and to mobile phones or other mobile devices. And it converts wireless signals to wired signals, and it sits between what's called the air interface, which is the radio interface between the phone and the base station, and the so-called backhaul, where the backhaul is the connection of the base station to the next level of an element in the respective cellular network technology. It's also the most visible part of cellular networks, and many people who didn't really look or at cellular networks or think much about them actually consider this. Those base stations, the network, but they are really just the edge, the outer rim, basically, of the network. Now we have, thanks to Kevin, a nice diagram that is available from Wikipedia, which shows you how a 2G network looks like. I'm not going to go into all of this. I'm just showing this as a point to illustrate that what we are talking about is this part, is the base station, and not just 2G, of course, also 3G, 4G, but this part, and we have a backhaul, and this is all the rest of the network which we're not talking about. That's where the actual logic happens, and the base station is really just a converter between radio and wired signals here. If we look at 3G, you see, there's actually not too much changes, and you can see the diagrams were also created from each other. So you see basically, oh, all the names changed. There was a UM interface, which was the radio interface. It's now called the UU interface, and it, what used to be a BTS, oops, sorry, is now a node B, and what used to be ABIS is now IUB, and everything gets new names. But fundamentally, we still have a base station there at the edge, and we have rather complicated core network. And for 4G, that doesn't change. I didn't bother putting up a slide. It's the same. You have a base station and lots of core network behind it. Well, what do we learn from this? If we look at these diagrams, what did you learn from looking at it for 20 seconds? We learned telecom world loves acronyms. There's lots of specifications by the 3GPP, which is the third generation partnership project, which writes specifications not only for the third generation for 3G, but also for 4G, 5G, and beyond. So maybe the name is handy to think about a new definition for that acronym. The cellular network contains lots of elements, and we really want to look at base stations. Now, the terminology that might appear here can be summarized in this nice table. We have the generations from 2G to 5G here, the name of the network technology, really. So GSM, the 2G technology, UMTS, the 3G technology, LTE, the 4G technology, and NR. Who knows what NR is for? Yeah, new radio. Not GNU radio, but new radio. Very confusing at times. And the base station names also extremely, illustrative. So we have the base transceiver station in the 2G network. We have the so-called node B in 3G, and then in LTE. LTE means long-term evolution. So the node B became an evolved node B. It's an E-node B. And in 5G, unfortunately, it did not become a, hyper-evolved or, mutated node B. No, it's called a G-node B. And according to some people who have participated in the specification process, the name finding went like, let's take F node B because F is the next letter in the alphabet after E, and then somebody vetoed that, and then they chose G because G is after F, the next letter in the alphabet. So that's the story that I've been told about how this comes. So the different backhaul technologies, we'll look at those in a bit more detail. The interfaces have different names. So from ABIS, we came to IUB, to S1, and now N2 and N3. Those are just names for the logical interface from the base station back to the core network, or whatever is the next element, which brings us to the last column, where in the 2G network, we have a base station controller, which is behind the backhaul. In the 3G, we have the radio network controller, the RNC. In LTE, we have the MME and the serving gateway that are basically the peers to which a base station talks. And in 5G new radio, it's the AMF authentication management function and user plane function, I think, but I may be wrong there. It's also new, this radio. Okay. One thing to talk about is site versus cell. So people talk about cellular base station. So if you see a picture like this, you know, is that the base station, or which part of it is the base station? And to clarify the terminology, we speak of a site or a cell site of a single physical geographical location. So one tower is a site. All the associated equipment there. In theory, of course, you know, when you start to look at the most simple ways of cellular networks, it's omnidirectional. In reality, they are not. They're all sectorized setups, so you have this typical three-sector configuration at a cell tower where you have three sector antennas, each covering 120 degrees around, and then we have the term cell, and the cell corresponds to one, let's say, coverage footprint in the cellular network. So the single site with three sectors actually has three cells. But then we have three different network generations. So we have 2G, 3G, and 4G. So at the end, a single site can, for example, have nine cells, because you have three 2G cells, three 3G cells, three 4G cells. So it means there's actually nine cells at a single site. And that's something to always keep in mind. Sometimes people use confusing terms. And also in terms of the logical elements, like let's say the BTS in GSM, a BTS, as the spec defines it, serves only a single cell. So actually at a site you have three BTSs because you have three sectors, each serving a different geographical footprint region on land or water or whatever, surface of the planet. So, yeah, that's for site versus cell terminology. And now, what kind of components do we actually find in cellular base stations? Well, of course, there is the, for IT people, rather boring part of the actual physical structure, the tower or pole or whatever it is, the mechanical civil engineering part. Then there are antennas attached to it, of course, since they receive and transmit radio waves. Typically, and we will get to that, you have coaxial cable to connect those antennas with something, because coaxial cable is what's used for conductive transport of radio frequencies. Then we have the actual base station electronics, which we'll look into a lot of detail later on in this talk. We also have some kind of backhaul connectivity from this site back to the rest of the network. And we have like environmental support functions such as power supply, fans, air conditioning, depending on the way how the site is structured. We'll look at that, UPS, and sometimes even generators, depending on this type of site and location and importance and so on. So if we look at it, like these are sort of the rough physical components, and if we look at it more in a logical way, in terms of what is happening to the radio waves, between radio waves and the actual messages on the backhaul interface, then we have a simplified receiver and transmitter chain, where basically we have some, in the receiver, we have some signal that is sent by the phone, it's picked up by an antenna, then typically, you go through some duplexer. The duplexer combines the receive and the transmit path. Then you have some filtering to filter all kinds of frequencies that you're not interested in. You have a low noise amplifier, which amplifies the resulting filtered signal, so you only get the amplification of the wanted signal, not of the unwanted signals. Then you have some kind of mixer or down converter, which converts the radio frequency down into baseband. So radio frequency in terms of cellular networks is basically anything from 700 megahertz and up. And then you convert the signal that was received down to baseband, like in any other receiver of any other radio technology. Then you have a baseband signal. You have, again, some filtering on that analog baseband side. Then you convert that using an analog digital converter into the digital domain, so you have samples. And then you basically have a physical layer implementation, whatever parts you will use to implement that physical layer. And on top of the physical layer, then you have higher level protocol layers like layer 2, layer 3, here symbolized by L2, L3. And in the transmitter chain, it's basically the exact opposite. So we start with higher layer protocol messages that go through the physical layer where all the signal processing and the math and so on is happening. Then we have a digital analog converter which converts those signals into analog waveforms in baseband, so basically centered around 0 hertz. We have some filter, some reconstruction filter after the digital analog converter. Then we have, again, a mixer to up-convert the signals, to shift them from baseband into the radio frequency spectrum, followed by possibly, you know, some more amplifiers, filters, whatnot, but this has a simplified chain. At some point, we have a power amplifier, a PA, which amplifies the signal to the signal strength that we actually want to transmit in order to reach our destination on the other end. After the power amplifier, you often have, again, some filters of the RF frequency. You go through the duplexer, which is actually the same part as here, depending on details, and then the antenna, and finally you transmit the signal. So that's sort of the logical path that is happening between the radio side and the backhaul side. And now the question is, how do we structure these, and how were those different parts structured at different generations of base station technology? And yeah, of course, in reality, it's more complex in many cases. So there's maybe more additional parts. But as I said, this is simplified. And if we simplify this even further to sort of arrive at fewer of those blocks, we again have our antenna at the radio side. We have radio frequency that goes into the mixer. After the mixer, we have analog baseband. So instead of gigahertz, we have 0 hertz, basically centered signals. We push those through an analog digital converter. Then we have what's called a digital baseband signal. And then we have, again, the physical layer implementation, which is all the signal processing that implements whatever radio specification that we are working with. And then typically you have what's called primitives, which are communication between the layer 2, layer 3, and further up the stack down to the physical layer and vice versa. And again, on the transmit side, it's the same. We have actual higher level protocol data units that gets sent via primitives into the physical layer, which emits baseband samples, which get converted to analog, which then get up converted to radio frequency, and which then get transmitted. And again, these are the blocks that we will deal with in the context of the actual hardware implementations that we will see. And what we will look at now is the evolution of cell sites. So I tried to find some pictures of interesting equipment. This is now a cell site. I think it's an RBS 2206 from Ericsson, dated around the year 2000. So basically, if you come to such a cell site at that generation, what you will find is mostly is an air-conditioned shelter on ground level. So you have some kind of building shelter. You open the door, and then inside there's an air condition, and there's some racks, and this is like one of those racks in there. And from there, you can see there's different units plugged in here, and different three more units plugged in here, and you see the thick coaxial cables coming out at the top. It's always typically RX and TX for each of the three sectors, so you have these six coaxial cables, and these go up the tower for I don't know how many meters or dozens of meters, and then up on the tower you have antennas. So the structure, how these cell sites, even in earlier days with analog cellular networks and with digital networks of the 2G and 3G systems were deployed, is like this. So you have these large racks, typically full with equipment, because the devices were rather large. We can actually see here 1, 2, 3, 4, 6 transceiver or power amplifier modules here in this rack, installed in air-conditioned shelters on ground level. So you first need to build that shelter, you need to put air condition there, you need to put the racks inside, you put the equipment in the racks, and so on. Then you put these long coaxial cables up the tower. And then you only have passive elements, which is the antennas on top of the tower, and you lose half of the transmitted power in the cable, because coaxial cable has losses, and that's the disadvantage with building cell sites in this traditional methods. So if we look at a slightly less classic cell site, so next step, couple of years later, the equipment became smaller, so you can see this is only a half-height rack to begin with, and it's only full to whatever, two-thirds, and there's space in between. Maybe we can actually, can we? No, we cannot zoom in here, can we? No, it doesn't want to zoom in this mode. Well, I can show the pictures larger and more detailed at some later point, in case anyone has an interest in that. So the equipment becomes smaller, there's no strict need for large shelters anymore, but of course lots of base stations have been built earlier, so the shelter was already there, so the large racks were there, but then they're only half full, like large data centers maybe some years ago, and now everything gets smaller. You still have the long coaxial cables and so on, and that same disadvantage. But if you build a new site, sometimes this equipment could already be in a small, let's say, outdoor cupboard or whatever kind of rack installation without a physical shelter around it. It became smaller, it became more tolerant to environmental conditions, you didn't need AC anymore, and so on. So that's sort of the next step of the logical evolution, not such a big step in practice. So getting back to those coaxial cables, why are they such a problem? Well, there are many problems with them. First of all, good cabling is between half an inch and an inch in diameter. That's the coaxial cabling you find at real-world cell sites. And that's actually not cabling, that's plumbing, right? You have copper tubes with 1 inch of diameter, and installing them, they're very rigid, and you cannot really bend them well, and you have also bend radius limitations, because quite often, actually, there's air as the dielectric between the inner conductor and the outside. You just have some plastic spacers, but you don't have like a thin coaxial cable. You use that there is some plastic insulator between the inner contact of the inner wire and the surrounding shielding. But in those corrugated copper large cables, actually mostly air is used as a dielectric component, and so if you bend them too much they will actually fold, and you know, anyway. And then you have losses. And if you've ever looked at coaxial cabling, for example, I don't know, with cable TV installation at home or satellite dishes, or you did anything with radio, you will notice that there can be quite a lot of losses in coaxial cables very quickly, especially if you think of the height of such a tower. It's not just, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 meters, but it may be 30 meters or more. And also, the amount of loss you have in a coaxial cable is a function of frequency. So the higher the frequency you get, the more losses you will incur in the same coaxial cable over the same length. So while the long cable might still have been okay for 900 megahertz GSM, when it went to 1800 megahertz, 2.1 gigahertz, 2.6 gigahertz, now 3.5 gigahertz and higher, you simply cannot afford those losses. So if you look at the characteristic loss of a coaxial cable over frequency, I mean, I don't have concrete values here, but it can easily be twice at double the frequency. So the losses increase significantly with frequency. And then also, of course, since people are getting spectrum hungry and everybody wants internet and not just SMS and phone calls, more bands need to be used in parallel, and that means more coaxial cables in most cases. So you have even more of those ruggedized, thick, expensive, long, lossy cables. So the logical conclusion is, you want to get rid of those coaxial cables. They have some advantages too, we will get to that, but you want to get rid of them somehow. And so the logical thing is, you want to generate the radio frequency closer to the antenna. The answer is, based on the old technology, it requires much more compact radio hardware. You cannot put an entire 19-inch rack up there on your cell tower. That will, you know, the construction might not support that, and it's not, you don't have air condition up there and so on. So you require passive cooling, of course, and IP64, 65, 67 ingress protection, so no water, no dust and so on should enter it. It must withstand, you know, direct sunlight, even in very hot countries, the temperature cycles, especially in like areas close to a desert or something. You have very cold temperatures at night and very hot temperatures during the day. So every day your entire equipment goes through very strong temperature cycles that affect your equipment. It's hard to service and replace because even though it's maybe smaller, it still weighs a lot. So the radio heads, which we will talk about soon, you can still talk about 20 to 30 kilograms for such a radio. You need to move it actually up the tower, need to install it, and if you need to replace it, it's a rather costly and time-consuming effort. But anyway, so the industry came up with something called radio heads, and mostly remote radio heads. So the solution is not to move the entire equipment all up the tower. So you basically say, okay, we just make everything smaller and there's more integration and so on. We put the entire base station equipment up the tower. No, we actually move only the analog parts up the tower, and everything that's digital we keep at the ground level, or maybe even somewhere else. So we split the base station in two parts. One is the baseband processing side, some vendors call it the digital unit, and the actual radio processing part, which is the radio unit. And the radio unit you move up the tower, and the digital unit you keep elsewhere. Might be at the bottom of the tower, but might also be elsewhere. So if we look at this simplified receiver chain, from earlier, and we bring in these concepts of baseband unit and radio head, we basically put, well, the antenna is still external. We get a radio frequency into this, not square, but rectangular box, which is the radio head, where all the filtering low noise amplifiers, mixer down conversion to analog baseband, and the analog digital conversion happens. And then digital baseband samples leave this radio head that's installed on top of the tower, and we have the baseband unit at the bottom of the tower or at a different location where then the physical layer processing is being done. That's where the digital mass is happening, and layer two, layer three processing is happening. And likewise, we have the inverse when we look at the transmitter chain. So the baseband unit at the bottom of the tower produces digital baseband samples, which get sent up the tower, where then they get converted into analog and amplified, mixed and amplified and filtered and so on, and they go into the transmit antenna. So that's the concept of radio heads. Now the question is, well, how does it look like? So there's some pictures of sites with such radio heads. As you can see, so this is just a zoom picture up such a tower. You have these large sector antennas here, these long devices with a down tilt. We will get to that. And then you have coaxial wires coming out of them, going here into this device, and that's the radio head. And you can see it has lots of cooling fins, a large heat sink on the backside for the passive cooling. So from the bottom of the tower to the top of the tower, where these radio heads and the antennas are located, all you have is DC power normally. So all the telecom equipment for traditional reasons has 48 volt DC. Sometimes you also have AC 230 volt inputs, but normally it's all 48 volt DC for historical reasons. And the baseband samples over, and I will talk about that shortly, fiber optics normally. This is another cell site where you can also see antennas here at the at various locations, and then you can see radio heads in other locations like here or here. It's not so clear, but there are other devices up there where the radio heads are located, and you don't have coaxial cables from all of these down the side. Or you actually have cell sites that look like that, where actually each of those units is a radio head here. And this is a building where antennas are just mounted on the building, so there is no large tower or something. The building itself is already high, but you have lots of radio heads here. I mean, you can count them. It's quite an amazing number of them. And basically all the fiber optics from those go into this cabinet, and then the fiber goes somewhere else where all the baseband processing is happening. Yeah, which introduces a new term, which is called front haul. I'm not sure who came up with it, but I'm sure it was a logical conclusion. We already have a backhaul from the cell to the core network, and now we have a new interface inside the cell between the radio head and the digital baseband, and that was called front haul then. And believe it or not, front haul itself, you could probably talk, I'm not sure, several lectures of I don't know how long only about front haul technologies and functional splits, and it's an entire science in itself. Typically, what you find there is fiber optic physical medium. It can also be copper if it's rather close. So in some cases, the different deployment scenarios, for some of your cells, you may need a radio head remotely up on the tower. For some other sites, you need the radio head close to the floor because you have the coaxial cable anyway and you just want to swap some old legacy equipment with new. And then you end up with cases where your digital unit is like 1 meter away from the radio head. And then, of course, you can use a copper cable. You don't need a fiber optic link at that distance because copper can carry the kind of speeds there. And we will get to the speeds we're talking here. The actual physical layer on those physical and link layer, actually, on those fiber optics, there is two commonly known systems and one that's coming up. One is called OPSI, the Open Base Station Architecture Initiative, which was launched in 2002 by a couple of companies listed here. Don't need to read the names. OPSI is mostly obsolete by now. It's still deployed in the field, but I'm not aware of anyone really putting new OPSI equipment in the market anymore. Some people claim it's related to the fact that it has more overhead, so you need even higher bit rates on the fiber, more expensive transceivers than CPRI, which is the competitor, the Common Public Radio Interface. which is again a consortium by Ericsson, Huawei, NEC, Alcatel-Lucent. And it has seen much more adoption. These CPRI specifications have already gone through more than at least seven major revisions. So always increasing the bit rates, adding new features. It's a real field by itself, all this front haul technology. And now, as I said, they are their own physical layer, own link layer, so they don't use Ethernet or something, even though it's, of course, fiber optic based. And now the newest trend is eCPRI, where eCPRI doesn't mean evolved CPRI, no. E means Ethernet. So actually what they are doing is they are using raw Ethernet frames to encapsulate packets of baseband samples. So you can use like 40 gigabit and up Ethernet switches for these kind of links rather than proprietary physical layers. Which has all kinds of problems in itself and new challenges. I think it's too early to say how widely it will be adopted, but you can already get eCPRI devices now in the market. I'm personally not very convinced that this is a technological step forward, but we'll see. Speaking of those fiber links there, how do you interface these fiber links? Most often the equipment actually will have normal SFP plus or XFP slots, and you can actually use normal, in quotes, transceivers as long as they support the bit rates that are needed there. So if you operate a rather low speed CPRI link, which will be 2.5 gigabits, for example, that's relatively low speed, then you need, of course, a transceiver that can handle this speed. A normal gigabit Ethernet transceiver might not do the job because it's specified for only 1250 megahertz and not for more than 2000 megahertz. So that's basically the physical form factor. So you plug in the transceivers, you have your LC connectors, you plug that in. You could also, like with Ethernet, you have the SFP plus transceivers for mono mode, for single mode, for wavelength division, multiplex, and so on. So that's basically the same technology, just with different bit rates than usually are used in Ethernet. I mean, of course, for 10 gigabit Ethernet, yes. Okay, so about the speeds, I had a slide somewhere. Okay, anyway, I'm going to diverge here from the slides just to give you an idea. A single sector LTE 20 megahertz signal. So you have a site, and on that site, we are looking at one of the sectors of that site, and that is, let's say, an LTE E-Node B, which has a radio bandwidth, a channel width of 20 megahertz, which is a typical deployment these days, with 2x2 MIMO. Then that single sector needs about 2 gigabits of data rate for the baseband samples. So you have three sectors, you can do the math, right? And then maybe you have some other technologies or even another band or more, so you quickly, even with LTE, not even thinking of 5G, you have data rates that are quite interesting on those CPRI links, and that's, yeah, because it's you basically get 16-bit INQ samples at very high sample rates that get transmitted in both directions. So this, but this kind of, having a fiber link, and anyone who's worked with fiber links in, let's say, Ethernet knows that once you have something on an SFP, on a single mode fiber, it can easily go many kilometers away. There's actually no requirement anymore to put the digital unit at the bottom of the tower, right? You can actually move the digital unit somewhere else just as long as your fiber goes there and you have the kind of speed and link budget and so on and the optical quality on that fiber. So you can dislocate those two, and that brings us to some people in the industry proposing what's called cloud RAN or also centralized RAN, or their different terms, or CRAN or DRAN, and it's all these marketing bullshit bingo terms, where the fundamental idea is, and I think this is, okay, the fundamental idea about this is, you move all your CPU-intensive tasks to more centralized locations like data centers where you can do GPU computing or you have large FPGA clusters or, God knows, optimized technology. And why would you do that? Well, first of all, it's easier to service and to replace and to upgrade in some data center and to maintain than having, you know, thousands of sites in the field. I think Deutsche Telekom, for example, has 40,000 sites in Germany, so that's quite a lot of locations you need to go to if you want to do some upgrade or something. The other point is, especially in some countries, I'm not going to mention any in particular, there are areas, residential areas of cities, and there are commercial areas of cities. And basically, during the night, everybody is in the residential area, and during the day, everybody is in the commercial area. So you sort of have load spikes in your network at different locations, which means you need to, in the classic model where you have the baseband processing unit at every cell, every site, you need to handle the peak of your traffic both in the residential and in the commercial area. So you basically need to put enough compute power at multiple locations of your network, despite the fact that you only needed half of the day in one location and half of the day in the other location. So by centralizing all this processing, the number of people doesn't change over the day, they just move around. So by centralizing all that processing, you can actually show that the amount of overall compute power you need is reduced in such Cloud RAN or centralized RAN scenarios. Yeah, the problem though is, as I said, the bit rates are high. So with multiple carriers on, you have more than 10 gigabits per site, and you need to backhaul all of that somewhere. And you also have, of course, latency constraints because speed of light or speed of optic propagation in fibers is limited. And you, depending on the length and the distance you have between your baseband processing and the antenna, that actually has an impact there. So I think I read something about 30 kilometers being sort of the maximum that you can realistically do these days. Otherwise, you will get problems with not fulfilling the latency requirements of the respective cellular systems. Okay, so that's basically from classic deployments to Cloud RAN. Where are we these days? I think Cloud RAN is mostly a marketing story these days. I'm not really the person who has all of the insight into that industry. I think some countries, particularly South Korea, are very much into this centralized CRAN or Cloud RAN infrastructure, but around here, I don't think anyone is using that. So what you have typically these days in Germany is the remote radio heads that I described in the previous step of the evolution. Now, all the digital baseband and fiber stuff, let's get a little bit towards antennas. And well, maybe you learned some antenna basics somewhere, and you always think of an antenna being this omnidirectional dipole that radiates basically 360 degrees. But yeah, in cellular base stations, that's not the case, as I mentioned before. And the complexity of antennas is actually quite interesting. If you have an interest in that, go to Catalyne.com, download the latest base station antenna catalog, and look at the antennas. It's mind-boggling what kind of antennas people can produce these days. But let's look at some of the technical advances in antenna technology over that time. So, cellular systems are specified as cellular systems are specified as using vertical polarization. That means your antenna is vertical, not horizontal. And that's also part of actually the spectrum licenses. So an operator could not say, now we rotate all of our antennas to horizontal, but no, the Bundesnetzagentur or whatever the regulator is actually has given you a license to transmit on vertical polarization. What the industry has moved to is actually to have so-called cross-polarized antennas, which don't have one radiator in the vertical direction, but you have two in plus, one in plus 45 degrees and the other one in minus 45 degrees. Basically, that in average you then get vertical polarization. And by using these two different radiators, you can have a number of different advantages. So there's some papers that say there's something called polarization gain, as the signals emitted from phones when they bounce around and get reflected from walls, of course the polarization doesn't stay the way how it should be. And by having antenna radiators in different polarizations, you may catch signals even at different polarizations than vertical polarization. Also, you can actually, for example, in an antenna that has two such elements, you can, for example, use two transmitters and have one transmit on minus 45 and the other one on plus 45 without having to use a combiner, where a combiner is a lossy component. So if you normally want to combine the output of two transmitters, you again lose half of the power of what you want to combine. There you can do it without any such losses, and that's possible because you have these 20-30 dB isolation. Also, you can operate RX and TX, so receive and transmit, without the use of a duplexer. Again, due to this isolation of the two radiators that you have. And also, you can use it for diversity reception. Diversity means you have multiple receive antennas and you dynamically pick and choose for every packet or message or whatever you decode, which of the antennas has received the best signal for that given packet that you received at the time. And since you have two of those, you can have polarization diversity in a single physical antenna that you deploy and not having to deploy multiple antennas for that. Okay, that's the cross-polarization. Then we have another topic, which is about bands. As I mentioned before, originally everybody in Europe was doing 900 megahertz GSM, then 1.8 gigahertz GSM was introduced, the so-called, in Germany, E-Netz. Then 3G was deployed mostly on 2.1 gigahertz, so you have all these different bands. By now you have 2.6 and 700 and all kinds of bands, 800. And what do you do on your site? I mean, do you add new antennas for each of those bands? I mean, at some point you have problems with the amount of weight or what your structure can support. You also have problems that they may affect each other, because in the near field of an antenna, basically any conductive material, any metal object that you put in the near field of an antenna will affect the radiation pattern of the antenna. So they influence each other. So what the antenna industry has responded with is multi-band antennas as a result for that. And now one more topic, and then we will look at some such examples of such high-end antennas. Another thing that was introduced is the so-called electrical tilt. As you have seen originally, I have to go back to one of the slides, the antennas have this down tilt. Where was that picture? The nice one. There we go. So yeah, that's sort of, the picture is a bit odd, but you see this is sort of the support pole here, and then the antenna is actually mounted with a tilt, and that's the down tilt that you do, the mechanical down tilt. And why do you have a down tilt at the antenna? Because you want your coverage area to end at a defined location on the surface of the planet. You don't want to radiate into infinity, but you want to radiate down to a certain radius of coverage, and beyond that coverage you have the next cell, which then also has a down tilt, so that if you sort of think of a light propagation, somebody with a flashlight pointing down from the antenna at that down tilt angle, at some point it will hit the ground, and that's sort of roughly where the coverage of the antenna is ending. Now the problem is, of course, you grow your network, so you put some new additional cells in there. That means the cells get smaller, so you need to climb up there and adjust all the down tilt everywhere again. Because then if the cell wants to be smaller, you need more down tilt, so, and so on. And that is what the antenna industry has solved with called electrical tilt or remote electrical tilt. So actually there is phase shifters and other devices, in analog phase shifters in the antenna, which can be adjusted. You can think of it maybe like a potentiometer or something with a motor. So you have a small electrical motor which moves some parts which affect the phase shift of the signal between the different radiating elements in the antenna. And by doing so, you can basically virtually down tilt your antenna. Even though mechanically it doesn't move, electrically the radiation pattern will tilt downwards. And that's what's electrical tilt. And there is remote electrical tilt, and there is protocols, like vendor-independent protocols on how to drive these motors for remote electrical tilt, and there is specifications for how the protocols for those motors are spoken over the coaxial cable in parallel to the radio frequency signal, so you don't have to run an additional wire up the tower to tilt those antennas. Well, next topic is with LTE, we also have MIMO. Multiple input, multiple output. I think most people will be familiar with this from Wi-Fi. You have multiple antennas, and by spatial diversity, you get higher throughput between receiver and transmitter than with a single antenna on both sides. And 2x2 MIMO is standard in LTE today. 4x4 starts to pick up. The first couple of phones, like I think the latest iPhone and the Galaxy S10, for example, have 4x4 MIMO, so they actually have four antennas in the phone to have four different spatial streams by spatial diversity. Which means, again, you have more antennas on the tower as well, because you multiple in, multiple out, you need multiple antennas on both sides. And it becomes really crazy if you look at 5G new radio, where people are talking about massive MIMO and massive multi-user MIMO, where then you have something like 32 to 64 antennas in a base station for a single band. That's, we won't go all that way, but if we look at, yeah, okay, that's the problem with the slide conversion. We don't get the pictures the way they were originally intended to be, but this is an antenna. At the bottom side, you see all these coaxial cables. You can guess there's quite a number of different radiators in there. Here you can actually see some structures with remote radio heads that are mounted there, so probably four radio heads and the corresponding number of coaxial cables going into that antenna. And if you look at cut line data sheets, we have 14-port antennas and now also 16-port antennas. Each of those coaxial connectors, that's not an SMA or something, that's what's called a 716 connector, which has about 1 inch in diameter, so it fits to these tube-like coaxial cables that you actually put. And here the AISG is this antenna interface special group or whatever, that's the protocol for the FlexRet, flexible remote electrical tilt in this antenna. Yeah, that's what it has come to in antennas, and now you think, okay, well, we have this antenna, we have then 16 cables from antenna to the radio heads, and all of that has to be installed up there some on the tower. Why do we do that? What's the next logical conclusion? We integrate the radio head inside the antenna. So it looks like this. It's antenna integrated radio is one industry term that has been framed by Ericsson. By Nokia calls it RAS, and Huawei has yet another term for that. So actually you have the classic antenna up to this line here. And then on the back here, you have the radio heads installed in the same physical device. Which means you have no coaxial cable at all. You go with the fiber directly into the antenna, which is basically the radio head plus antenna and has everything inside, just power and fiber. Well, the disadvantage is now that you're talking about something like 30 kilograms or more for that unit that need to be fixed, and it had a wind load, and you know it shouldn't fall down at some instance. So it needs to be mechanically installed. Now, one would think everything is great with that. The problem is, if you're a field technician, how and where do you measure? You don't have a coaxial cable anymore where you can attach your spectrum analyzer to see what is actually received by the antenna, right? And the receiver that's built into the radio head only receives the specific band for which it was designed, because it has band filters to filter out everything out of the spectrum. So you don't really have a... So you go to a cell site, traditionally a cell site, you can go without climbing, you go into the shelter, you unconnect some coaxial cable, you attach your spectrum analyzer, and you see what kind of signals your antenna receives, what kind of interference interference, no matter on which frequency or whatever you see it. But with these antennas, you don't. So actually, to do that, you have two choices. Either is there is now so-called CPRI spectrum analyzers, which basically you put the fiber optic splitter between the radio head and the digital unit, and then your spectrum analyzer gets the digital samples and just presents them as a spectrum to you, does the FFT and so on. But there you only see in band, which is like in your specific frequency band, or in channel interference and nothing outside. And if you want to see interference or whatever on other frequencies, you actually need to climb up, and often there is a small port in the back end of the antenna, a coaxial port, where you can actually still measure what is received. But you cannot do that on ground level anymore. So it has advantages and disadvantages. So not everybody is so excited about these devices. Okay, that for antennas. Classic backhaul. Yeah, so now this chapter is about the backhaul. We've spoken about the front haul, the antennas, and so on. Backhaul. Starting with 2G, old stuff. 2G was specified when ISDN was hot. And therefore, the backhaul of GSM-based transceiver stations is specified over E1, T1 lines, which some people call ISDN primary rate interfaces, PRI. And an E1 link has 30 usable time slots of 64 kilobits each. One of them is used for signaling. The other ones are used for voice calls, where one quarter of a 64 kilobit slot is used for each voice call. So you can easily compute how many voice calls you can run on such a line. And the interesting factor is GSM is still very well deployed today and will be for quite a number of additional years. 3GPP has never specified any other transport technology for backhaul than E1 interfaces. So this results that every vendor has come up with their own proprietary clutch on how to carry this ABIS signaling over IP or Ethernet or whatever. So you have some special devices which then convert the E1 to IP. And even though ISDN is no longer available for individuals or companies as a fixed line technology, I'm not sure what's the status in Germany, but at least all over Europe, lots of E1 is still in operation as cell-site backhaul for GSM backstations. So that's the last stronghold of ISDN, basically, because yeah, the equipment is there, the lines are there, and as said, you need to add additional devices to convert the E1 to something over IP, and you need the inverse devices at the other end, and it's all not so great. Getting us to 3G, which was specified when ATM was the next hot thing. Not sure how many people in here have heard of ITM or are old enough to remember. The asynchronous transfer mode was a very hot topic. It was supposed to be the technology after ISDN, and then it completely disappeared, and Ethernet won the war against anything else. And so the backhaul was originally specified for 3G over ATM. And ATM at that time, in reality, often used four E1 lines using technology called inverse ATM multiplex, where ATM is sort of transported over four E1 lines of the previous technology ISDN. And then you have, again, the inverse multiplex on the other end to recombine that. It's rather interesting. But at least in 3G case, the specification body 3GPP has later adapted the specs for an IP-based transport. So there is a official way how to do this over IP. And it's amazing because every single voice frame that you transport from a phone call ends up split over three different UDP packets that you need to resynchronize and re-multiplex in your software because that's how they did it. Because they modeled it after the way how the radio interface is done and how they did it over ATM. And yeah, anyway. So with 4G, LTE was specified at a time when IP was hot. So it's the first 3GPP cellular technology that's transported over IP from day one, from the time it was specified. So we don't have any exotic physical layers or link layers or anything like that. It's just Ethernet in most cases. And actually, some operators have gone as far as to do it IPv6 only. So there are backhaul networks that don't even have legacy IP as a transport anymore. I just got some E-Node Bs that were running at Vodafone Netherlands, and they only have IPv6 addresses configured. They don't even have IPv4 addresses configured anymore. So, yeah, the problem is when you move to Ethernet, all these previous technologies coming from a strong telecom background, they all transported clock. So the receiver could recover a clock, a reference clock from the signal that he received, which in Ethernet doesn't exist. And when I'm talking about clock, I'm not talking about the time of day, but I'm talking about a frequency reference that allows you to calibrate and to discipline your local oscillators in order to transmit at very precise carrier frequencies, which is required by cellular base stations, which brings us to the topic of clocking, where if you have an IP-based backhaul, how on earth do you get a proper clock reference? The Ethernet physical layer, the bits are with no guaranteed or whatever reference clock. The frames have jitter and so on, so there is nothing that you can really derive a proper clock from. And the requirements for cellular base stations are to have very precise transmit frequencies. The requirement is in the magnitude of 30 parts per billion. That's about 1,000 times more accurate than the normal crystals that you buy in electronics. Even ovenized crystal oscillators are not long time stable enough. So where do you get your clock from? You have a couple of alternatives. One is you use what's called a GPSDO, a GPS disciplined oscillator, which uses a GPS signal not to determine your position, but to derive a clock, because each GPS satellite has multiple atomic clocks inside, and you can actually sort of discipline how it's called. So you derive a local clock that is almost as accurate as the clock in the GPS satellites. The problem is, of course, you have created a single point of failure. If GPS ever is not in operation, then all your cell base stations will start to behave interestingly. Now, of course, yes, you can do it with Galileo or with GLONASS or with Baidu or whatever, but fundamentally it's always the same topic. And the other options are to use something called synchronous Ethernet. I'm not sure if anyone has ever heard of it. I think it's virtually unknown outside of the telecom world, where basically in a normal Ethernet switch, the switch is a store and forward switch. It receives a packet from one port, it stores it in local memory, and then it will transmit the packet over another port of the switch. And the transmission is done using the local crystal oscillator that's in the switch. So any kind of bit clock from receiving a packet will not propagate to transmitting a packet. And in synchronous Ethernet, that changes. So when you receive a packet, your receiver recovers the clock of the transmitter, and then it uses that clock information, the recovered clock information, to clock the bits of the next packet that it transmits. So basically, you have a synchronous relationship of incoming and outgoing Ethernet packets in a switch. And that then propagates clock information, but it means you need to buy super expensive synchronous Ethernet switches, and you cannot use any of the normal switches, which sort of invalidates the idea of using Ethernet in the first place, I think. Or you can use something called IEEE PTP, which I hope somebody at least knows in here. The precision timing protocol, also used in multimedia areas and in video areas for synchronizing all kinds of devices. It's not really intended for the kind of precision that is used or that is required, but you can do it. Particularly if your switches don't introduce too much jitter. Or, and that's actually done in some cases, or at least equipment supports it, you can use NTP, but NTP's precision is way insufficient. So I have some Ericsson base stations which send 10 NTP requests per second, each of them, in order to really try to brute force to derive a clock from NTP. Which is actually what we did at the camp. So there was a Stratum Zero NTP server with a GPS disciplined oscillator, and all the LTE base stations were hammering that one to try to lock a clock to it. Yeah, so looking at the electronics inside such devices, let's look at the baseband first. The typical basebands have, well, some massive amount of computing power. It's really, we are talking about many, many, many gigaflops of computing power that you need to do all the math in the modern, let's say, LTE or even 5G physical layer. Some smaller cells are built, for example, on Texas Instruments Keystone 2 processors, where each of them has 864-bit 1.2 gigahertz DSPs and lots of hardware peripherals to do FFT and crypto and turbo decoder and Viterbi accelerator and God knows what. And they then also have built-in controllers or peripherals for this CPRI or OPSI interface for the baseband samples, and you have a couple of ARM cores for layer 2, layer 3 processing. But those kind of DSPs, even though the specs look quite interesting, they're really only suitable for rather small cells. So what you find often is actually FPGAs and or vendor-specific ASICs. And Ericsson, for example, is very big on ASICs. It's their strategy for many years. You can even find, I think, 10 or 15 years ago, you can find papers published by Ericsson on how they have optimized their fab for doing low-quantity ASICs, which are only specifically used in their base stations. And I just found a new presentation they did this year in 2019, and actually they claim that their current ASICs have 10.5 billion transistors inside, which is the same, you know, just to give you an idea, about the same as an Apple A12X or a Huawei Kirin 900, so the super high-end smartphone processors that we can find. And that's what they build, not for millions of smartphones, but only for tens to hundreds of thousands of, probably at rather tens of thousands of base stations. So of course the cost of all the man years and the investment in creating the ASICs has to be broken down on much lower quantity of devices. Why do they do it? Because there's, I think, no realistic way you can get to the kind of computational power you need in there, in the energy budget that you have. So, I mean, you don't want to have a nuclear power plant next to your base station just to power all the compute and the related air conditioning and so on. And Ericsson has published some figures that compared to implementing the physical layer in DSPs, I think it was a factor of 20 at least in power savings compared to their ASIC implementations. So that's, of course, very significant. And once again, you typically don't want air-conditioned shelters, but you want small passive cooled equipment that you can install outdoor. If we look at the radio heads, there are typically in those radio heads, there are so-called, these days at least, so-called RFICs, radio frequency integrated circuits, that do pretty much everything that used to be discrete components in the past. So they include ADC, DAC, so analog-digital, digital-analog conversion, up-down conversion, mixer. They include clock synthesizers, all kinds of configurable, tunable on-chip filters, and quite sophisticated devices by themselves. Also rather expensive integrated circuits. And then next to that, you have analog power amplifiers, typically two driver stages and then a final power amplifier, which are specific RF power amplifier transistors, which are only built for building power amplifiers of cellular base stations and in specific production processes using specific materials. So that's not a CMOS technology. Then often you have something called a circulator, which protects the power amplifier from any kind of energy that's reflected back from the antenna. Because if you don't have proper matching, you have a high standing wave ratio. That means some of the energy that your transmitter outputs gets reflected back from the antenna or from some broken connector or something into the radio head, and you want to protect the power amplifier from that reflected energy, and the circulator helps to sort of to eliminate that reflected energy from and make sure it doesn't damage your power amplifier. And then you have a cavity duplexer, which is a rather large blob of milled aluminium, typically with silver coating on the inside. It's quite fascinating. I should actually have put a picture here. So these duplexers are responsible for combining the receiver and the transmitter side to one antenna, for example. And in the end, it's basically, it's two band passes, if you think of it in electrical terms. So you have one band pass for the transmit band and one band pass for the receive band. And it's a pure mechanical device. There is no resistor, there is nothing. It's just a blob of aluminium with milled cavities, and they all resonate somehow with each other. And in the end, you have some very nice deep, I don't know, how seventh order, whatever, eighth order filter, which has very nice deep curves and no insertion loss and whatnot. Fascinating devices. If you're interested in that, check out cavity duplexes. You find videos of people taking them apart. Then also, importantly, in the radio heads, you have something called pre-distortion, or mostly adaptive pre-distortion, or actually digital adaptive pre-distortion. Now, what does that do? The problem is that power amplifiers are non-linear, like any transistor. It's not linear. If you ever look at the slope of a transistor transfer function, this non-linearity causes problems with signals, particularly signals that have so-called high peak average power ratio, which unfortunately means LTE and 5G signals, basically, what you do is your physical layer computes some digital samples, they convert it to analog, they go through the power amplifier, and the power amplifier distorts it. And then you have a small receiver that again digitizes basically what you just transmitted, but after the power amplifier, then it does all kinds of magic math to determine what exactly was the nonlinear transfer function that the amplifier applied, and then you pre-distort the next samples you put into the transmitter by some compensation function to compensate the non-linearities of these power amplifiers. This can be even more complex than some of the other signal processing in the devices. I don't know much about it, but it's applied math. So looking at the software and coming towards the end, if you ever have an interest in analyzing software that runs in base stations, don't expect too many things that you have seen before anywhere else. You're looking at decades of proprietary in-house development of large corporations that have done nothing but developing this stuff. The operating system that you find most frequently is called Enea OSE. Now, who has ever heard of that? Yeah, exactly. It's a Scandinavian company, which might explain why it's popular with Ericsson and Nokia devices. It's a proprietary microkernel architecture with custom everything around it, from file systems to inter-process communication to basically anything. You can find VXWorks sometimes, but not so often. I think there were some Huawei radio heads where VXWorks was used, including Chinese language VXWorks shell commands, or at least shell help, which is also not extremely helpful to people on this side of the planet trying to play with them. And Linux you find mostly only in small cells, which inherit their stacks from femtocells, which were basically consumer-grade devices where Linux was used more frequently. It might be different in the very latest generation of devices, but at least on all the most of the equipment that I'm familiar with, Linux is not very very frequently used, let's say. I think that it's gaining some market share against the competition, but yeah, it's mostly weird stuff. So some links for further reading. Actually, if you're interested in the hardware side of things, there's one guy who calls himself Kaiser Power Electronics with AIZ written on YouTube. He does actually teardown videos of cellular base station equipment and many other things. But actually, like he looks at, let's say, Nokia Flexi WCDMA or Ericsson RBX 6000, actually, sorry, not 600. And it's like three videos of each, I don't know how long, only doing teardown of such a base station and looking at the PCB, identifying the chips, and, you know, unmounting all the screws of the cavity duplexer, looking how it looks inside. It's quite amazing that he's doing all these videos for such a super niche topic. I've also put the CPRI specs there if you're interested in all this front hall technology stuff. yeah, there's of course many other links. You can always check out the Osmocom wiki or mailing lists or whatnot. Yeah, and that brings me to the end. And I hope not everyone is bored to death, but has some interesting questions by now.
So, thanks. Do I have... Thanks. This was a lot.
Oh, it was just the introduction.
Yeah, just the introduction. So, yeah, please come back for the next round. Do we have questions? Yes.
On the pictures from the early slides, you've shown some base stations, some antennas. Which polarization are they using? I mean, the main question is this cross polarization. Is it looking different from the regular vertical polarization?
No, you don't see it. The antennas always look the same way, these sector antennas. Now, where did we have that? No, not there. That picture. I mean, looking at this antenna, looking at the number of coaxial ports at the bottom, it's a rather modern antenna, and I'm sure it uses cross-polarization. But you cannot just... It's the same fiberglass. You don't know what kind of radiating elements are inside. You have to open it, which, by the way, also people do on YouTube. There are people who are actually cutting open cellular base station antennas and showing you how the remote electrical tilt operates, and it's... Yeah.
I have a question regarding this taking apart videos. Yeah. Where do they get that stuff?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. eBay, I think, is at least the most well-known source for a lot of devices. That's also where I got a lot of equipment. There are also companies that are doing refurbished retail of such equipment. So the operators don't do any of that themselves. The operators say, oh, all of this equipment gets phased out. Then some general contractor gets the job of basically unmounting all that equipment, and then they sell it as spare parts or whatever on a secondhand market, and actually companies where you can buy it in quantity secondhand for very little money. So let's say such a radio head you can get, if you're lucky, for 250 euros. And I mean, I'm sure if you buy it new from Ericsson, it will be a completely different magnitude.
Okay, one follow-up question, sorry. Because I know some of these retailers, they retail stuff, they resell stuff, they get somewhere, but they don't have really a clue because they do all these different things. So they'll just put in random stuff and you can get it cheap. But here that's like specialized.
Yes, they're specialized companies that are trading in surplus or refurbished telecom equipment, and they don't do anything else. And you can ask them for the stock list, and then you get an Excel sheet with I don't know how many thousands of lines and spare part numbers, and then you can look at the Ericsson spare part catalog that is leaked somewhere on Scripty or, you know, academia.org or whatever it is. So
Huawei has a technology they call single RAN. Have you run across that? Which is basically the concept of moving, I think, airspace towards a specific technology, like 3G, 2G, 4G?
That's pretty normal now from every vendor. I'm not specifically familiar with that, but the way how this evolved was originally you had dedicated digital units for GSM and for 3G and for LTE. And now, and also maybe dedicated radio heads. The first thing that happened is that the radio heads became universal. I mean, basically, it's just samples, so what do they care what's in those samples, right? And then also the digital units, the baseband units, became more universal. So now, these days, if you also from Ericsson, whatever kind of equipment, even the previous and the current generation of baseband units, which interestingly Ericsson actually calls them baseband as a product now. So you have a baseband 5216 or something like that. They do all technologies also in combinations. So on a, I think it's a 52 or 5516, you can actually do LTE and 3G and 2G at the same time on multiple sectors. And you can completely dynamically software reconfigurable change what you do, how many GSM channels versus what LTE band, versus it's all pure software at that point.
Question about the Cloud RAN. how's that working in practice? Are they like using leased lines? Is there
dark fiber? Going,
huh?
Dark fiber.
Dark fiber. Okay. So that also means they probably don't do like any TLS or whatever at these data rates.
Not that I'm aware of. No, not on the front haul. So the way how LTE, for example, is specified. So all of the stuff that's happening on the front haul with CPRI and OPSI and all these technologies, that's completely outside of the scope of the 3GPP specifications. So that's just, let's say, an implementation detail of how some vendor chose to implement their base station devices. And there's neither CPRI nor OPSI, to my knowledge, has any kind of security built in. It's just baseband samples. The backhaul, basically, from the digital unit back to whatever is the rest of the network, there the specifications say that the equipment must support IPsec. It doesn't require the operator actually to enable it, or it also doesn't, how can I say, it doesn't forbid the equipment vendor from charging additional license fee if the operator wanted to enable IPsec. But at least the equipment, if it claims spec compliance, it has to have support for IPsec. That's the situation there on those lines.
Do we have more questions? Yes, another one.
Any ideas about CDMA? I mean, it's popular in the US, and what is the backhaul between the core network?
I don't know. It's too alien for me. Honestly, I have no idea. I never really investigated it. But I think it's also dead, mostly. I mean, it's not dead, but maybe it's mostly of historical value. The LTE in the US is the same LTE that we have here, and the 5G is the same. It's just maybe different bands, but same network architecture.
Thank you.
Well, yeah, they don't have Huawei, of course, but apart from that, it's the same.
Okay, I don't think there are any more questions for now. So thank you very much again, Howard. And please, another round of applause.